Henshaw was the Shangani word for a falcon, and Sean had heard them use it many times over the last 5 days of their trek, and each time as they said the word, they looked up at the sky with a troubled expression. Now, once again, the mention of that bird, they looked unhappy, and as a reflex glanced upwards. "General China thinks so," the sergeant went on. "But who knows? Who knows?" By now, Sean was confident that his position was fairly secure. His relationship with the band would allow him to take the first liberty and force a resolution of this trial by attrition. On the next stage, he began to force the pace. Instead of keeping his station on the file of trotting men 2 paces behind the Shangani sergeant who led the column, he closed up until he was running on his heels, not quite touching him with each stride, and exaggerating his breathing so that the sergeant could feel it on the back of his thick, sweaty neck. Instinctively, the sergeant lengthened his own stride, and Sean matched him, keeping close, too close, and pushing him. The sergeant glanced over his shoulder irritably, and Sean grinned at him, breathing into his face. The sergeant's eyes narrowed slightly as he realized what was happening. Then he grinned back at Sean and extended his stride into a full run. "That's it, my friend," Sean said in English. "Now let's see whose tail wags." The rest of the column had fallen behind. The sergeant called a sharp order to them to close up, and they went away at a killing pace. Within an hour, there were only 3 of them left. The others were straggled back over a mile of the forest floor, and ahead of them, the path climbed a steep incline to the crest of another tableland. Sean moved up slightly until he was running shoulder to shoulder with a tall sergeant, but when he tried to pull ahead, the man kept with him. The hillside was so steep that the path went up it in a series of hairpins, and the sergeant forged ahead of Sean at the first bend, but Sean caught him and passed him on the straight. They ran at the top of their speed now, the lead changing back and forth between them, and the third man dropped out before they were halfway up the hillside. They ran grimly, in a wash of sweat, their breathing harsh as the exhaust of a steam engine. Suddenly Sean darted off the path, scrambling straight upwards, cutting across the bend and coming out 50 feet ahead of the Shangani. The sergeant shouted angrily at this ruse and cut the next bend himself. Now both of them abandoned the pathway and ran straight at the steep slope, jumping over boulders and roots like a pair of blue kudu bulls in flight. Sean came out on the crest 3 feet in front of the sergeant and threw himself down on the hard earth and rolled onto his back, moaning for breath. The sergeant dropped beside him with his breath sobbing in his chest. After a minute, Sean sat up uncertainly, and they stared at each other in awe. Then Sean began to laugh. It was a harsh, painful cackle, but after a few seconds, the Shangani laughed with him, though clearly each gust of laughter was an agony. Their laughter grew stronger as their lungs regained function, and when the rest of the party struggled to the crest of the hill, they found them still sitting in the grass beside the track, roaring at each other like a pair of lunatics. When the march resumed an hour later, the sergeant left the endless footpath and struck off across the country towards the west, and there was at last direction and purpose in the way he led the column. Sean realized that the trial was over. Before dark, they ran into a Renamo line of permanent defences. They were entrenched along the bank of a wide but sluggish river that flowed green between sandbars and round water-polished boulders. The dugouts and trenches were revetted with logs and sandbags and meticulously camouflaged against aerial discovery. There were mortars and heavy machine guns dug in, with commanding fields of fire across the river and sweeping the northern bank. Sean had the impression that these fortifications were extensive, and he guessed that this was the perimeter of a large military area, certainly battalion and possibly even division strength. Once they'd crossed the river and been passed through the defences, Sean's appearance in the ranks of his escort created a stir of interest. Off-duty troopers turned out of their dugouts and crowded around them, and his captors were clearly enjoying the elevated status that a white prisoner bestowed upon them. The crowd of interested and jocular onlookers abruptly thinned and parted as a tubby, bespectacled officer strode through them. His escort saluted him with theatrical flourishes, which he returned by touching the rim of his maroon beret with the tip of his swagger stick. "Colonel Courtney," he greeted Sean in passable English, "we have been warned to expect you." For Sean it was refreshing to notice that Renamo wore conventional badges of rank based on the Portuguese army conventions. This man had red field officer flashes and the single crowns of a major on his epaulettes. During the Bush War, the Turs had eschewed the capitalist imperialistic traditions and dispensed with the symbols of an elitist officer class. "You'll spend the night with us," the major told him, "and I look forward to having you as our guest in mess tonight." This was an extraordinary treatment, and even Sean's captors were impressed, and in a strange way, rather proud of him. The sergeant himself escorted Sean down to the river, and even produced a fragment of green soap for him to wash out his bush jacket and shorts. While they dried on a sun-heated rock, Sean wallowed naked in the pool, and then used the last of the soap to wash his hair and rid his face of camouflage cream and ingrained dirt. He had not shaved since he had left Chiwewe camp almost 2 weeks previously, and his beard felt thick and substantial. He worked up a lather of suds in his armpits and crotch and looked down at his own body. There was not a vestige of fat on him. Each individual muscle was outlined clearly beneath the sun-darkened skin. He had not been in this extreme condition since the closing days of the war. He was like a thoroughbred racehorse brought up to its peak by a skillful trainer on the eve of a major race. The sergeant lent him a steel comb and he brushed his hair out. It fell almost to his shoulders, thick and wavy and sparkling from the wash. He put on his damp clothes and let them dry on his body. He felt good. That charged, restless feeling of being at the very pinnacle of physical fitness. The officer's mess was an underground dugout devoid of ornament or decoration. The furniture was crude and hand-hewn. His hosts were the major, a captain, and two young subalterns. The food made up for its lack of artistic presentation by its abundance. A huge, steaming bowl of stew made with sun-dried fish and chilies, the fiery piri-piri that was a relic of the Portuguese colonialists, and great mounds of the ubiquitous maize meal porridge. It was the best meal Sean had eaten since leaving Chiwewe. But the highlight of the evening was the drink that the major provided, unlimited quantities of real civilized beer in metal cans. The labels read, "Castle Lager," and in small print at the bottom, "Verwaardigen South Africa," made in South Africa. It was an indication as to which country was Renamo's good friend. As the guest in the mess, Sean proposed the first toast. He stood and raised his beer can. "Renamo," he said, "and the people of Mozambique." The major replied, "President Botha and the people of South Africa," which settled it conclusively. They knew Sean was from the south and was, therefore, an honoured guest. He felt so secure in their company that he could relax and for the first time in months allow himself to get moderately drunk. The major had fought for the Rhodesians during the Bush War. He told Sean that, like Joe Bikani, he had been a subaltern in the Rhodesian African Rifles, the elite black regiment which had fought so effectively and inflicted such slaughter amongst the Zandla guerrillas. They soon established the camaraderie of old brothers-in-arms. Without obviously pumping him, Sean was able to nudge the conversation along and pick up the crumbs of information that the major let fall more freely as the cans of beer were consumed. Sean's estimation had been correct. This was part of the northern perimeter of a Renamo army group. The fortifications were deep and dispersed as a precaution against aerial bombardment. From this base, they marauded southwards, hitting the Frelimo garrisons and strafing and raiding the railway line between Beira on the coast and Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe. While they were still working on the first case of beer, Sean and the Major discussed with seriousness the significance of that rail link. Zimbabwe was a completely landlocked nation. Its only arteries to the outside world were the two railway lines. The major one was southwards into South Africa via Johannesburg to the major ports of Durban and Cape Town. Mugabe's Marxist government bitterly resented being reliant on the nation which, for them, epitomised all that was evil in Africa, the bastion of capitalism and the free market system, the nation which had for 11 long years of the Bush War propped up the white regime of Ian Smith. Mugabe's hysterical rhetoric against his southern neighbour was incessant, and yet the foul hand of apartheid was curled around his jugular vein. His instinct was to look eastwards, into Mozambique, for salvation. During his struggle for independence, Mugabe had been nobly assisted by the Frelimo president of Mozambique, Samora Machel, whose own struggle against the Portuguese had only just culminated in freedom from the colonial yoke. Frelimo, his brother Marxists, had provided Mugabe with recruits and arms and full support for his guerrillas. Without reservation, they had offered him the use of bases within their territory from which to launch his attacks on Rhodesia. It was only natural, now that he turned once more to Mozambique, to provide an escape from this awful humiliation of being seen by the rest of Africa, by his brothers in the Organization of African Unity, to be dealing with a monster of the South, not only dealing with, but totally dependent upon it for every liter of gasoline, for every ounce of the daily stuff of survival. The railway line to the port of Beira on the Mozambique Channel was the natural solution to his predicament. Of course, the port facilities and the mainline system under the African socialist management had been allowed to fall into almost total disrepair. The solution to that was simple and well tried. Massive aid from the developed nations of the West. As every good African Marxist knew, they were fully entitled to this, and any attempt to withhold it could be countered by the equally simple and well-tried expedient of dubbing it blatant racism. That dread accusation would force immediate compliance. The estimate of the costs of work needed to restore the port and main line to full efficiency was $4 billion. However, as actual costs in Africa usually exceeded estimates by 100%, the sum of $8 billion was more realistic. A mere bagatelle, nothing more than their due, a fair price for the West to pay for the pleasure and prestige that Mugabe would derive from being able to thumb his nose at the monster of the South. There was only one small obstacle in his way, the army of Renamo. It sat astride that vital rail link, attacking it almost daily, blowing up bridges and culverts, ripping out the tracks and shooting up rolling stock. The actual damage they caused was minor compared to the fact that their depredations gave the Western governments a fine excuse for withholding the funds needed to restore the main line to the condition in which it would be able to carry all of Zimbabwe's imports and exports. The Frelimo government's efforts to protect the line were so fumbling and inept that the Zimbabweans themselves were forced to assist them. Over 10,000 of Mugabe's own troops were tied up in trying to fend off Renamo attacks on the line. Sean had heard estimates of the cost of these operations to Zimbabwe's economy, already one of the shakiest in sub-Saharan Africa, as high as $1 million a day. It was ironic that Mugabe, once the guerrilla, was now forced into the role of passive defender of fixed hardware and permanent positions. He was experiencing the stings of the flea that he had once so merrily dispensed. Sean and the Renamo Major laughed at the joke and began on the second case of good apartheid lager. This marked the passing of the time for serious conversation. Now they reminisced happily about the days of the Bush War, and they soon discovered that they had both been at the same contact in the Mavarodonas on the day when they had killed 46 guerrillas, a good kill, as a successful action was always referred to.